Welcome, everybody, to Season 2 of the Tennis Worthy Podcast, brought to you by the International Tennis Hall of Fame. I'm Brett Haber. In 2023, the Hall of Fame launched the Tennis Worthy Podcast with 12 in-depth interviews with legends of the game, such as Tracy Austin, Leighton Hewitt, Yvonne Lendl, Mats Wielander, Mary Pierce, and John Newcomb. These fascinating interviews are all still available on tennisfame.com/podcast. And we're excited to be launching Season 2 of these interviews with legends right here. Chris Bowers, an esteemed tennis journalist of more than three decades and biographer of Roger Federer and Novak Djokovic, will be chatting with our legendary guests here on Tennis Worthy. We start with a four-time Grand Slam champion, world number one, and two-time Davis Cup winner from the 1990s, a member of a golden generation of American male champions, and now a regular media personality on the tennis circuit, Jim Courier.
I didn't play basketball as a kid, but if I was on a basketball team, I'd be the one that wanted the ball as the buzzer beater was coming. I wanted the shot. That's the thing that the best pros do, is they have everything that's in their controls under control. When we're on the court, you put your mask on and you perform, and then you shake hands and you're back to being friends. Don't expect that things are going to happen because people tell you you're great. You got to go earn it every day.
Jim grew up in Florida, profiting from the tutelage of such contrasting coaches as Harry Hopman on one end and Nick Bollettieri on the other. And he speaks totally honestly about the different cultures those two highly successful coaches engendered. As you would expect if you know anything about Jim, he is brutally honest about the ups and downs of his career.
Jim, what is the attribute that you think makes a Hall of Famer?
Well, I think good luck. You have to start there. You have to have the right setup. You need a good family situation most of the time, because that's how most tennis players will find themselves on a tennis court, is because someone in their family is interested in it. And then from there, it takes a series of events with a lot of luck, a lot of hard work, a lot of persistence and dedication, and ultimately, a desire to perfect your craft and be willing to make lots of sacrifices along the way. Tennis is one example of that, but anyone who wants to be great at anything has to sort of find that silver bullet, if you will, of we're going to stay committed to this, we're going to ride the ups and downs of whatever it is. I'm going to be a great musician, if I want to be a talented writer, whatever the case may be. It's not that it has to be all-consuming, but it has to be enough consuming that you put your life's work into it.
You've talked a lot about growing up in Dade City near Miami, and that there wasn't a lot of tennis infrastructure there.
Right.
Was there enough backup in your family and friends so that you got the start that you needed and that you've just talked about?
So tennis in the 1970s, when I was a child, was extremely popular with families. It was very much a sport that was aspirational. A lot of people that didn't even play tennis wanted to dress like tennis players. It was the era of Arthur Ashe and Billie Jean King and Martina Navratilova and Chris Everett and Bjorn Borg and John McEnroe, and it was cool. So my parents did it because it was cool. They did it with their friends, and they weren't particularly great tennis players. They were good athletes who played tennis, but it was something they loved and they enjoyed. And as a child, my sister and I, we would go to the tennis courts, the local public park with my parents, and we'd play on the jungle gym, but we wanted to do what our parents were doing, as most children do. So we fell into the sport. There wasn't a great infrastructure in town. There was no tennis club in town. There were just some public courts and high school courts. But my parents saw that I was passionate about it, and they got a basket of balls, and they would feed balls to me, and we found a local college coach who was a good educator as far as teaching tennis to a young person like myself, and we took it step by step. We were blind. We had no idea where we're going, but it worked out amazingly well.
So when did you first get the sense that you had the determination to put in the work necessary?
I think I had that very early, and I think I had that in general.
When did you start? What's your age?
I started playing tournaments when I was about 7 or 8. But I was the kid, whether it was a baseball that I would throw against the wall and have it come back to me, I was the kid who didn't want to leave whatever I was doing. I never wanted the sun to go down, because I wanted to keep playing, whether it was tennis or baseball or football or riding my bicycle. I just had that type of personality. So tennis was a great outlet for me, because it was one of the few sports at that time in the United States that you could play year-round.
You talk about having played other sports. When it came to the decision to focusing on one, what were the thoughts that led you to tennis?
So it was really a question of not wanting to be left behind. And I was very passionate about baseball. I was very passionate about tennis. And in tennis, it was a little easier to understand where you stood in the hierarchy because there was a ranking system, not just a state ranking system, but a national ranking system. So I knew where I stood. I knew that by the age of 13, I was number 5 in the United States. And in baseball, I was good, but I didn't know how good because there was no way to know. You knew you were good in your area and your state, but you didn't know what else was out there. So for me, tennis was a very logical decision to go to because I knew that worst case, and this was going to be a best case in a lot of ways, I was going to get a scholarship to play tennis at a college. So it was going to be my pathway to the next level of education, and then whatever life would follow after that would be my path. But I didn't think professional tennis was on the horizon. I wasn't one of those chosen ones, but I knew that if I chose tennis, that it was going to be good to me and it was going to provide opportunities.
Makes it sound very mathematical when you're talking about motivation. Is that just post hoc rationalization for what happened, or were you conscious of that at the time?
I'm also extremely competitive, as most people are that played sports at that level. I was very competitive, and I also played a year of baseball in the summer, and my tennis suffered because I wasn't playing the national tournaments. My ranking dropped for a period, and I had to work my way back up. So there were practical realities happening around me that I could see if I didn't commit to it. I needed to commit to one of them. I had to if I wanted to keep up in either sport. And I just knew mathematically that tennis was going to guarantee me a Division I scholarship someplace that would lead to better things in life.
So as a youngster playing, you must have played against kids who had the same sort of forehands and backhands as you.
Yeah.
What made you win most of the matches?
I think my instincts were really good. From what I hear, Chris, my mom tells me that even when I was 8 and 9 and 10 years old, when it was pressure moments in matches, I was aggressive. I had the thirst for those moments, and I didn't back down. I wasn't afraid to play at those moments. Effectively, if we're talking about a basketball team, I didn't play basketball as a kid, but if I was on a basketball team, I'd be the one that wanted the ball as the buzzer beater was coming. I wanted the shot. I didn't want to pass the ball and give up responsibility. I embraced pressure, and I think that's something that was evident pretty early from what my mom tells me.
Was that just how you were, or do you think somebody taught you to seize difficult moments?
I think that's who I am. And it's funny when you nowadays we have the luxury of being able to watch some of our great current players when they were young kids on YouTube. There's wonderful video of them playing, and you can see those instincts in someone like Alcaraz. His aggressive instincts, his instinct for his thirst for danger in big moments was there from the beginning, it appears. And I think that's true of most players. I think most players have a personality type that really shows in the choices they make when the chips are down.
Did you have setbacks or doubts?
Tons of setbacks and doubts. I didn't have a lot of injuries when I was young. I was very fortunate with my body, Chris, and not all players are lucky like that. But I had certainly plenty of moments of doubt where I didn't think I was going to be good enough. And tennis can be a tough sport because of the solitary nature of it. As you know, it can be difficult to process loss for the emotional state you're in. So you have to learn how to do that over time. But I had plenty of setbacks, plenty of moments where I didn't think I was going to be able to do it. But I had enough fuel and determination to keep pushing forward anyway.
And did you have the right people around you to help process? Because processing on your own is hard. It's a lot easier when someone can reflect back to you.
First of all, I had and have a great family, a very supportive family who never made their attention on me dependent on my results. So I was very, and I had brothers and sisters, a brother and a sister too. So it wasn't always just about what I was doing, and it was a very healthy environment from a family standpoint. And at Bollettieri's, I was incredibly lucky to have access to Dr. Jim Lehrer, one of the first sports psychologists, at least in the United States, still a preeminent voice. And we could go talk to him and get things off of our chest at a time when I don't think that was readily available to many athletes in general.
I'll come back to Jim Lehrer in a minute, but your first guru that you came into contact with is Harry Hopman.
That's right.
What did you learn from Harry?
Mr. Hopman was amazing because I went down there I'd been earning money mowing lawns in my neighborhood, and I earned enough money to go down there. I had another friend who was coming down for the weekend, a gal from who played national tournaments with us. She came down with her family, and it was $50 a day in 1981 to go to Harry Hopman's for like a day pass, which is
so
a lot of money.
9, 10 years old?
I'm 11 years old.
11.
So I saved my money. I had my $100, and I went down there and paid my $100 to go. My mom took me down there, drove me down. It was about an hour and 10-minute drive from our house. And I did the camp, and Mr. Hopman put me on a court with another really good junior player that I played with, and he worked us out hard, and I'd never seen anything like it. I think he was doing the same drills that he would do with Rocket and Fiery and all the great Aussies, and he was testing me. And it was amazing to see what the next level looked like, because I didn't have any idea what that looked like. And there were other pros around, too, but it was my first taste with high, high-level tennis training, and I was smitten.
And he was always Mr. Hopman.
Mr. Hopman, absolutely.
And so then, a couple of years later, you went to Bolotari's. What did Nick give you, Nick Bolotari, compared with Hopman?
So there were different environments. Mr. Hopman's environment was much more sort of old school. It was regimented. It was quiet. It was, you know, very refined from that standpoint. Nick's was much more of a renegade outfit. No one's wearing a shirt. There's a lot of screaming and yelling and you know, racket tossing in a very different environment. And it was a little bit more of the Wild West. But there was so much appetite for success and so much desire on display. And at the same time, Nick was extremely progressive with having sports, you know, strength and conditioning coaches, having a sports psychologist on board. There was just a lot of progressive thinking going on there because Nick didn't believe in the box. He wanted to jump over the box and create his own playground for us to play in. And above all, Nick collected players. At that point, he would offer scholarships to people like myself, and there were a lot of hungry people there that wanted to get better, that were willing to do everything to get to the top, and it was amazing, the energy.
So if it was a bit of the Wild West with people not wearing shirts and throwing their rackets,
which is a bad idea for me, Chris, because I don't tan, so I don't know why I did that.
Well, you're very blonde, aren't you?
Yeah, it was red.
Where did the discipline come from? Because there must have been some at such a successful academy as Bolotari's.
Well, there was discipline in what you were doing on the court. There wasn't discipline as it revolved around the behavior. There was a lot more lax there than at Hopman's, for sure. But, you know, Nick was a taskmaster, came from a military background. So, you know, when you went on his court in particular, you were at attention and ready to get his attention and try and keep it and try and impress him. So it was a special place with its own little momentum, right? Players competing day in and day out in these cutthroat matches where you're in ladders and groups and you're trying to stay in your group. And if you lose, you might get demoted effectively. So
it's a constant competition.
Constant competition, which was an amazing ambiance to be around.
And did that find certain people out? Did people leave because they couldn't stand the competition and people like you survived?
Probably. I never really thought of it that way because I was so young and so myopic at that time, but I'm sure that it culled plenty of the herd.
We mentioned Jim Lehr. I mean, as the preeminent tennis psychologist, he's obviously helped lots of people. What did he help you with?
Well, first of all, just having someone listen is really important. For mental health has become such a hot button topic now, and it was a taboo back then. It was a sign of weakness. If you talked about needing help mentally, you were indicating quote unquote weakness as an athlete. That's not the case. It's just another area that needs to be nurtured, like your lungs and your legs and every other muscle that you need to play tennis. Your fragile ego is something that needs to be nurtured too when you're losing and winning on a daily basis. So Jim was first and foremost a place to go talk about what was happening and have him be real thoughtful about it, give you some feedback on that. But he also helped with dealing with stress on the court by giving a lot of us rituals and systems to deal with stress. So ways to stay focused and not get distracted with everything that was going on around you. So you had a template of what to do in between points that gave you that framework to stay focused.
We got on to Jim Lehr because I asked you about setbacks.
Yes.
So looking back, how did you overcome your setbacks?
Well, There were many ways to overcome them. Sometimes it would be writing thoughts down, keeping journals, and then looking at them a few days later and trying to figure out exactly what it all meant and finding a way to stay motivated. I mean, tennis is a relentless business, tournaments week in and week out, one winner, you know, many enter, only one leaves undefeated. So you had to learn how to deal with those setbacks. And ultimately, it also came down to having not just people like Jim Lehrer around, but also people like Brad Stein and Jose Aguirre around, or Craig Boynton, that could help me set goals and understand that I was still trying to get better. It didn't matter what the ranking next to my name was, whether it was a single digit or whether it was triple digits, still areas to improve. And that was a way to keep things moving forward and to sort of cushion the blows of some tough defeats that inevitably happen if you play at this level.
If you look at the progress of your career, it really took off in early 91 when you won Indian Wells, Key Biscayne and Roland Garros. Mm-hmm. But you turned professional 3 years earlier, and the build-up in those 3 years was gradual, just one title in that time. Mm. What were you building up? What strengths were you building up?
There's a lot of learnings when you come on the tour. You learn where your weaknesses are pretty quickly because these veteran pros who are savvy, they'll exploit you. So I learned that I needed more defense on my backhand. It was too fragile. I learned that I needed to add things like a slice backhand to play defense and stay in rallies. I learned that my fitness wasn't good enough on many occasions as a young pro when I would run out of gas and cramp up in matches and lose because my fitness wasn't up to standard. Ultimately, what I learned, which was a real key in that time frame, Chris, was I learned that my opponents had strengths and weaknesses too. And I started looking across the net and better understanding that they could make mistakes and help me. And I didn't have to do everything myself. As an offensive-minded player, sometimes I would be too offensive and would make a lot of mistakes, and that would hurt the end result.
Anyone who watched you playing at your prime would be astonished to say, my fitness wasn't good enough, I had to work on it. Because you were at your peak, strong as an ox.
But this was before that. This was the first couple of years on tour when I lost quite a few matches due to fitness. And then I made a determination, I'm not going to lose any matches, or I'm going to do everything in my power at least to be as fit as I possibly can. And I'm going to check every box that I can control. Like, that's the thing that the best pros do, is they have everything that's in their controls under control, and they're prepared for all the inevitabilities, because there are always things that are outside of your control that your opponent's doing, that the weather's doing, that the schedule does, that you just have to deal with. But if you take care of what's on your plate, you have more energy to deal with the other stuff.
You had a slightly unconventional playing style. Mm-hmm. Had you taken some elements from other sports that you played, and in fact were you aware that you had something that was a bit different to others?
I did know that my backhand was unconventional, and I deeply regret that I didn't listen to my coaches to change it when I should have. But I was a stubborn kid, and there's something to stubbornness leading to some success, but it also led to me having to overcome my backhand inefficiency. You know, the grip was definitely a problem. It was a baseball backhand swing. So I tried not to hit too many backhands, and I tried to work on making it at least solid enough not to hurt me. And it became a shot that I could at least rely on to make, but it wasn't a weapon, and it could have been possibly if I had a little better technique.
In that wonderful period from middle of 91 to early 93, you won four slams. Mm. Most of the time you were number one in the world. How did you deal with being world number one, which is a role, albeit one without any definition?
Well, it's one that you learn on the fly, because there's no school to prepare you for that necessarily. You learn that there are commitments that you have to deal with. There are lots of people who want things for you for all the right reasons, and sometimes not, but you learn how to filter. And above all, you learn how to keep the people that are meaningful to you very close to you. That's a dangerous time to make new friends, let's put it that way. And I was very good at that. I was very good at staying insular and focused and not losing the energy that I needed to extraneous activities. So I continued to try and get better as a tennis player all throughout my career. But, you know, certainly in that time period, it was head down, move forward, keep getting better, because that's what led me to that position in the first place.
Your first Grand Slam title, you beat Agassi in five sets in the final. You'd been with him at Bollettieri's. You said in an interview not so long ago you'd seen him in his underpants, mm-hmm. which I found a lovely line, mm-hmm. because it indicates you've seen him vulnerable.
Yeah.
Is that a mental ploy that you use, that imagining somebody, whether you have seen them in their underpants or not, without clothes, as a way of taking the fear away?
The fear of the moment in playing a major final for me was in that case, was playing the moment. It wasn't playing the man. If I had played someone that had been more of a hero to me, if it had been more of a McEnroe, a Borg, a Lendl, you know, all these players, and I'm leaving so many out that I would have been intimidated by, Mats Wielander, people that I'd watched and dreamed of being on the court with, that would have been, you know, much more of a hurdle to overcome. And we see that with the modern players having to face someone like Djokovic in a final, that it's intimidating to face him on top of the situation. But Andre was my peer. You know, I slept in the same room as he had for many, many years, and I knew he was just a kid like me chasing a dream. So it was more easy for me to manage that aspect of the moment, because of, you know, the fact that we were just peers. And I think that stands true today. You look at Sinner and Alcaraz, and Sinner's not in the least intimidated by Alcaraz and plays great against him because they played a lot of junior tournaments together, I'm sure.
You're also a peer of Pete Sampras, mm-hmm. but you didn't spend as much of your childhood with him. Mm. Was there a different way of dealing with Pete, especially as you used to play golf together in the early days?
Well, Pete and I turned pro the same day. We were doubles partners for the first couple of years on tour together and practiced a ton, ate every meal together. Pete and I were as close as anybody. He was my best friend on tour the first couple of years out before we started to do better in singles and primarily before we got girlfriends. And that was really what sort of broke up the brohood, if you will. But
So don't get a girlfriend.
No, it was great. That was a great part of life, too. It was necessary. So, you know, Pete and I were extremely close, and that you know, that had very little to do on the court. You know, the fact that we're friends, we're certainly able to put that away, and we're all chasing big prizes and we're big boys, and he was better than I was. We had a lot of great battles, and it was a lot of fun to be a part of that generation with him. But I was every bit as close to him, even closer than I was with Andre, certainly from a personal standpoint at that time in our lives.
And how did you learn to deal with not being a good friend of his when he was on the other side of the net?
I learned that very quickly. I think I had that innately. If you ask Mark Knowles, who has been one of my best friends since that time too, Mark and I were at Bolitarius together as well. We played very early on. He got a wild card into a small ATP tournament, and we played in the first round. And I beat him. And after the match, he still tells me, he's like, you looked me in the eye. You were pumping your fist the whole way like you didn't know who I was. And then when we shook hands, you said, you apologized to me and said, sorry, man, business is business. And that was sort of the way that I approached it. When we're on the court, you put your mask on and you perform, and then you shake hands and you're back to being friends.
At your peak, you were on the wrong end of Stefan Edberg's single best match in the US Open final. He beat you. You won six games against him. And yet 4 months later, you beat him in the Australian Open final. Mm. Was that just two different days, or had you learnt something that you then put into practice in Melbourne?
Both. Stefan played so well. I don't know that I could have possibly made it. I mean, I was playing great in that tournament. I didn't lose a set en route to the final, and he just crushed me. He was awesome. And by the time we got to Australia, I'd picked up a little bit on his service patterns after studying the match and had a little bit of a better idea of how I wanted to play him. And Stefan and I had played several matches. You mentioned the one title I'd won as a teenager. That was against Stefan in Basel. I beat him 7-5 in the fifth set. So we'd had some battles before, and he'd never played as well as he did against me in the U.S. Open that year in 91. But then I played, you know, unbelievably well against him from there on in.
So you beat him again in 93. Then you got to the Roland Garros final, which you lost in five.
I
did. Got to the Wimbledon final, which you lost in four, when you looked like you were mounting a really good comeback.
Yeah.
After that, you seemed to lose something. When you look at your career trajectory, did something inside you get lost, or did other players just work you out, or what?
I think it's probably more that other players started to work me out. Certainly Pete started to work me out. You know, Pete really started to lift after that Wimbledon title. That was really the beginning of his big run, where he would be year in number one, I think six straight years. So Pete put a stop to a lot of my progress after that. But there were other players like Cedric Pealing, who beat me at the U.S. Open that year in the round of 16, who figured out if he hit his backhand down the line, I couldn't run around and hit forehands inside out. So there were players started to pick up on my patterns and started to see how I was vulnerable, and it was harder for me. And I kept working every bit as hard, had some success, but it was never quite the same as that little run you mentioned before where I had that, you know, really strong run to a lot of finals.
I suppose not knowing what the future holds means that you look forward to the next 7 years. You went on playing for 7 years after the middle of 93. And yet you never achieved anything like what you'd achieved in the 2.5 years before.
Yeah, but I'm so grateful for ever being on tour, first of all. Like, that's not something that I ever had taken for granted. Like, I wasn't a kid at the age of 12 that was looking at it going, oh, I'm definitely good enough to be on tour. You know, that this was a dream of mine to be a top 100 player for 10 years. That was my goal the day that I turned pro. I got to be in the show. I got to be a big part of the show for a period of that time. And I've lived an amazing life through tennis, so I have nothing but gratitude for it. And I would have been very, very happy to have done much, much less in tennis.
That's interesting. Is that, again, post hoc rationalization, or?
You could have asked me at any time in my career, and I would have told you, I can't believe how lucky I am that this is happening.
Let me ask you something else, which is not strictly relevant to tennis, but I wonder how much it helped building your own character. You learnt French.
Mm-hmm.
You learnt a bit of Spanish as well.
Mm-hmm.
And you were willing to speak French.
C'est vrai.
On court, mm-hmm. at Roland Garros. Mm-hmm. What did that do for your broader tennis game and yourself as a person?
So when I grew up playing tennis, I also grew up playing music. My grandmother, rest her soul, bought me a drum set, and my parents allowed that to take place because this was not one of your electronic drum kits that makes no noise. This was the booming acoustic full set with big crash cymbals and everything. So I was always quite musical, and I loved playing music. I'm still musical to today. I have a drum, little electronic drum set at home for my kids that I get on more than they do, and I have a bunch of guitars, and I love music. So that's another language, and I love music. And I fell in love with French. Brad Stein, who was traveling with me as one of my coaches back in that time, Brad speaks French. So I started to become interested in the language, and then I made a determination after I won Roland Garros the first time that if I was ever lucky enough to win it again, I was going to try and say a few words in French. So I just bought a little book, and I would study every night. It was actually one of the great things in that time period of my life when everything around me was changing, that I would just simply sit at home or in my hotel room and read a little bit of French and study it every night for 6 straight months. And then I became courageous enough to start speaking my, you know, basically kindergarten or first grade French level in public. And I love it because it's another way that your brain operates. It's another area of your brain that activates when you find yourself in another language. And I did enough of it that when I'm in France now and I speak again, that there'll be nights where I'll dream in French. And that's always so interesting when my brain converts over to that language for just, you know, even if it's only for like an hour.
Because there's a generally recognized link that the soccer players who live in a foreign country, if they learn the language, mm-hmm. they're far more likely to succeed.
That's interesting.
And I just wonder whether you felt that it helped make you a better tennis player, not just that you had the crowd with you at Roland Garros.
I don't think that necessarily it made me a better tennis player, but I think it probably was part of the package that allowed me to play better tennis because there was a time with a lot of distraction available to me and I stayed focused on improving. And that's part of improving as a human being is to find things that you can get better on. And I was doing that while I was, you know, pursuing another dream.
One other aspect of tennis, you played a lot of Davis Cup. Mm. You were on two winning teams, 92-95. You played an amazing live fifth rubber in 99 against Rozetsky. Mm. What did the team variant of an essentially individual sport do for you, having played team sports as a kid?
I loved it. I loved being a part of the team because of my background of playing a lot of baseball. I think I was a good team player. I was very supportive of my teammates, and I loved getting their support as well because it's a interesting dynamic when you have our teams, which were largely comprised of people that were winning the majors at that point in time, coming together and pooling our energy in one direction as opposed to fighting each other for a prize. So it was an interesting dynamic, and I loved the practice days as much as I loved the matches, the card games, the meals together, the camaraderie. those are some of my fondest memories in tennis. Not just the weekend matches, but the Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday when it's the build-up to it.
Because you played in that amazing team in the final in 92. Mm. You, Sampras, Agassi, and McEnroe.
Yep.
Did you all put your egos sufficiently to one side?
We did. And it was interesting because at that point in time, John and Pete were the doubles team. So Andre and I were playing singles. That's how good the team was. So they did an amazing job of sort of helping get us ready for the singles and then doing their job in doubles. And it was an amazing team to be a part of. I still kind of pinch myself.
In 2005, you were inducted into the International Tennis Hall of Fame. In your induction speech, you said, "I've always been alive." Mm. What did you mean by that?
Well, I think that when you are lucky enough to play in a sport like tennis, where you get feedback on a constant basis, you realize that you're alive. You don't have to wait to know how you're feeling. It happens very naturally. So I feel really lucky that I've just always had the job that allowed me to feel so much emotion, whether it was positive or negative. There was never really a day that it was boring. There was certainly never a day where I doubted whether I was feeling good or bad, because I knew something either hurt or it didn't. I'd won or I'd lost, but I was in touch with those emotions. And that, for me, is what life is about, is those emotional connections. And that's before I was married and had kids. And, you know, that takes on a different kind of different mindset. It takes on a different meaning. But at that point in my life, I had met my wife, didn't have kids, but I was very much alive in my own little space.
Do you sometimes see people and you think, I wish you were a bit more alive?
I do. But that also helps me realize that I've been very fortunate.
The world is full of kids who play tennis and dream of making it to the top. Some have a chance. What would you say to aspiring kids and their parents about how to handle the hazards of childhood as a gifted tennis player?
So the thing that I would say first and foremost to the parents is let your children pull you into the sport as opposed to you pushing them into the sport. I think it's a healthier way to go, and I've seen both sides of that coin. I'm someone who pulled my parents into the sport, and they supported it, and I never resented the sport as a result of that. But the other side of that coin, you see a lot of players and hear a lot of stories about players who resent the childhood that they live. We only get to be children once. They should enjoy it. For the children, just enjoy it. Just go have fun, go get it, and see what happens. But don't expect that things are going to happen because people tell you you're great. You got to go earn it every day. Tennis is a meritocracy. The tennis ball doesn't care where you're from, what you look like. It just goes where it's told to go. So if you're good enough to tell it where to go, you can put your hands on some pretty good hardware at a big tournament someday.
Jim Courier, it's wonderful that you consider yourself lucky. So are the people that interact with you. Thank you very much for sharing your thoughts and memories.
Thank you, Chris.
You've been listening to Jim Courier talking with Chris Bowers. And when you hear that interview, it's no wonder Jim is one of the most astute commentators in tennis today and one of the great on-court interviewers at the end of matches. Next time, we hear from another man who triumphed at both the Australian and French Opens, but in a much earlier era, going back to the 1950s and extending into the mid-70s, a man who truly straddled two very different eras of tennis, the Aussie legend Ken Rosewall. Don't miss that interview, and if you enjoyed our interview with Jim Courier, do tell your friends, colleagues, and family about the Tennis Worthy podcast. The best way to support these interviews is to spread the word so they reach as many people as possible, and not just tennis fans. There's a lot of wisdom in them for people in all walks of life. The Tennis Worthy podcast is brought to you by the International Tennis Hall of Fame in association with the Tennis Radio Network. I'm Brett Haber. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you again next time.